The headlines. President Raisi of Iran says the Islamic Republic trusts its own people instead of pinning its hopes on Vienna or New York. Russia and Ukraine failed to patch up their differences on how to interpret a deal they signed years ago on ending the conflict in the Donbass region. And also, thousands of Sudanese returned to the streets in their latest mass rally to make their voices heard against last year's military coup. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half hour marks the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, the top of the Western-backed Pahlavi regime. Iranians across the country marched to commemorate the victory of the Islamic Revolution. In some cities, demonstrators marched towards major squares and iconic places to mark the occasion. In other areas, people use their cars or motorcycles in an effort to observe health protocols for COVID. The Islamic Revolution was led by the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini. The revolution emerged victorious on February the 11th, 1979, after months of protests nationwide against the Pahlavi regime. Also in Iran, President Ebrahim Raisi has delivered a speech in the capital, Tehran, at a ceremony marking the anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. He says his government has pinned no hopes on the West and relies solely on the Iranian people in achieving political and economic goals.
I trust in God and I trust in people. Our foreign policy is based on balance, but the view towards the West has caused an imbalance. Our hopes are in God and our own regions, including provinces of Khuzestan, Khorasan, Azerbaijan, from the east to the west, north and south of the country. We have no hope in Vienna and New York.
President Raisi added the country's progress requires unity and said the future is very bright. He also said Iran has always managed to protect its political independence. The Iranian president noted that the Islamic Republic neither accepts any domination nor engages in any act of oppression. In addition, he added the Islamic Republic of Iran always seeks justice and plays a decisive role in the region. President Raisi hailed the Iranian people for their huge turnout in the rallies making the victory of the Islam, marking, that is, the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Political commentator Firas Al-Najm says the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran has inspired many people worldwide to human rights and equality, as well as the fight against injustice.
First, I would like to congratulate the Iranian nation and all the free people in the world on this great occasion, remembering this powerful movement that shook the evil entities of the world. And till this day, paralyzed every hand that wants to extend to oppress and colonize and suppress people and take away their rights and plunder their resources. This movement really inspired many people in the world, as well as human rights organizations, as well as activists. We see that Imam Khomeini's message in every protest almost in the world has a place. I mean, his quotes, people that lived in Iran as well, that came to these countries as well, always have this strong determination. They are very inspirational people. And this movement gives a lot of life to people to fight for human rights, to fight for equality, to fight for justice, to fight injustice. And as we can see today, Iran is the leader in fighting injustice. Iran is the leader to stand up against the bullying powers, the global arrogant powers, as you call them, the tyrannical powers. We see that USA thinks that they can break every law in the world, and they think they're above the law, and that they can create any law they want. And they want the whole world to be submissive to the laws that they push through as their agenda. But Iran has stood up to them, has resisted, has made a stand that they will not be part of the system.
Abbas Aslani is a journalist and political commentator in Iran. He says the 1979 Islamic Revolution brought changes not only to Iran, but also to the entire region, as it gave a boost to Islamic unity.
This was a big change in the country, as well as a change in the region, because it shook the world as well as the region. And you can see that the currents can even be felt today. It redrew geopolitical orders in many ways, at least in the region. You can see that the revolution gave a boost to Islamic unity in resisting against Israel. It opened new fronts against Israel. If that was only some Palestinian groups in the past, before the revolution, resisting against Israel, you could see that after the revolution, this changed, and we could see a Muslim unity. And but when it comes to the, let's say, U.S. hegemony in the world, including in the region, the revolution somehow presented an Islamic flavor to the anti-imperialist as well as anti-American sentiments in the Middle East.
Iran is widely recognized as the undisputed possessor of the largest missile program in the West Asia region. And this next report will tell you about Iran's latest achievements.
Meet the latest addition to Iran's diverse missile arsenal, Khaybar Shekan, a state-of-the-art missile unveiled earlier this week. It can strike its targets within a range of 1,450 kilometers with pinpoint precision. The ballistic missile is solid-fueled and therefore will be ready for launch much faster than liquid-fueled projectiles. It's even much faster and lighter than other Iranian solid-fueled models and can carry a powerful warhead. Ballistic missiles fly up into outer space before returning to hit their targets with a somehow predictable trajectory. This makes them vulnerable to interception by air defense systems. But Iran's armed forces say Khaybar Shekan boasts high maneuverability when it dives down, making it a nightmare for any advanced missile shield. Iran has been manufacturing various types of military equipment and weapons, including missiles, despite many rounds of Western sanctions against its arms industry and other sectors. Missiles are one of the cornerstones of Iran's defense doctrine. Iran has the Middle East's most diverse arsenal of projectiles. From very short-range rockets to advanced ballistic and cruise missiles with pinpoint capabilities, Iran has been working hard to enhance them, both in terms of range and precision.
Iran is merely trying to keep up in order to defend itself. I mean, I'm sure Iran and the Islamic Revolution would like to spend that money elsewhere. But as long as you're being threatened, it is necessary to develop yourself to a degree in order to be able to have that defense. Now, you can have all the greatness that you want, but if you're not capable of defending it, you'll eventually lose it.
The Iranians insist that the volatile situation in the Middle East and security threats in this neighborhood have left the country with no option other than developing its own deterrent force. And they say missiles are absolutely crucial to their defense program. Iran has ruled out any negotiation over its missile program, saying that it's a red line.
The Iranian pursuit of more advanced projectiles has been relentless. It makes no secret of it, because Tehran says they are a must for effective defense in the world's most dangerous region. But how did Iran master the technology to produce advanced projectiles despite decades of sanctions and import bans imposed by the West? The Iranian missile program grew out of the war initiated by the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s. Saddam's forces showered Iranian cities with missiles and bombs provided by the East and the West, while Iranians say no one sold them any proper means of defense. Iranians argue that they had no choice but building their own defense industry domestically and independently. The latest Iranian achievements are a far cry from the earliest models. Meanwhile, the West, especially the United States and its close allies, have described Iran's missile arsenal as a threat. They have tried to push Iran to abandon it, but Iranians seem to have learned to listen from the past and insist that their defensive missile power is a red line that will never be negotiated.
There has been a great deal of growing hostility towards Iran from the imperialist powers, and that in doing so, they have forced Iran to develop greater and greater weapons with the capacity to defend themselves. They are under assault from imperialism, and this is a constant ongoing threat from the United States, Israel, and Saudi Arabia, who have formed the imperialist bloc inside of the Middle East.
When repeated Israeli threats against Iran are taken into account, the need for a robust defense program seems more urgent. Iran says its military might will enhance regional security. It also insists that it will never start a war, but if attacked, a crushing response will definitely follow.
Well, Iran and the remaining parties to the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA continued talks. In Austria, this is the eighth round of negotiations to restore the agreement, which was thrown into chaos by the U.S. unilateral withdrawal back in 2018. We're now joined by our correspondent, Homa Lezgi, who's with us from the Austrian capital with more details. Homa, welcome to the program. What details do you have to share with us at this point of the negotiations?
Yes, Bardio. Today we had news that the three working groups working on three different issues in the Vienna talks have met, starting with the working group on nuclear measures or nuclear commitments by Iran. Iran's return to full compliance with the JCPOA meeting this morning. We're hearing for up to 3 hours. After that, we had the working group on sequencing or implementation. Of course, the working groups we know are made up of the experts representing both the Iranian team and the other teams from the 4+1 group, the remaining signatories of the JCPOA. And we just heard that the third working group on sanctions lifting is also meeting with the experts discussing the outstanding remaining issues. Earlier, the Russian ambassador to the talks, Mikhail Ulyanov, tweeted that he has had another, quote, very useful meeting with U.S. Representative Rob Malley. And in the words of Mr. Ulyanov, we are definitely moving ahead. He also said that the intensive negotiations that are currently taking place at the working group levels on all the major issues up for discussion here is taking place as the talks are apparently, in his words, in the final stage. So, again, last night there was a meeting between the 4+1 group and the U.S. Concerning the developments made. So what are the remaining outstanding issues? Up until this stage, we know the most important is guarantees. Iran insisting that it will not back down from that. It wants guarantees that can give it assurances the U.S. will not withdraw again. Can a future U.S. administration, can this administration assure that a future administration in the U.S. will not withdraw, will not reimpose sanctions? Is that going to be possible? How is Iran going to be assured on that? This is one of the questions. Also, there's verification, and that's the amount of time that's required, known as the preparation period, before implementation of a possible restored deal, whereby the U.S., by various means, will verify the effective removal of sanctions. And, of course, in order to verify Iran's compliance, there is the International Atomic Energy Agency. So verification on all sides.
Thanks a lot, Homa Lezgi, joining us from Vienna. Also, Russia and Ukraine failed to reach a breakthrough in their talks aimed at ending years-long differences on conflict in eastern Ukraine. The Russian envoy says the two sides could not reconcile their different interpretations of the 2015 Minsk agreement. That deal was aimed at ending the fight between Ukrainian government forces and pro-Russian groups in the Donbass region. Russia accuses Ukraine of trying to rewrite the agreement and pick elements most advantageous to it. But Ukraine says it's committed to the accord. At the end of the one-day talks held in Berlin, Ukraine's envoy said Both sides have, however, agreed to keep talking to diffuse tensions. The conflict in the Donbass region in eastern Ukraine simmers despite a ceasefire, with the sides occasionally engaging in deadly encounters. Ukraine accuses Russia of sending forces to Ukraine to fight alongside the separatists, but Moscow says it has nothing to do with the conflict. Ukraine and its Western allies also accuse Moscow of planning to invade Ukraine, citing Russia's troop buildup along the border with Ukraine. Russia denies any such plan, saying that it's trying to enforce red lines to ensure the Western security alliance NATO does not expand further eastward. Thousands of Sudanese once again take to the streets to protest against last year's military coup that upended a transition to civilian rule. The crowds waved flags and chanted slogans in the capital Khartoum and its twin city, Omdurman. Security forces fired tear gas to disperse the demonstrators. No casualties were reported. Sudan has been witnessing regular protests since the October coup led by Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. The military takeover then derailed a power-sharing arrangement between army and civilian leaders following the 2019 ouster of longtime ruler Omar al-Bashir. Nearly 80 people have been killed and hundreds of others injured since then. People are also calling for justice for those who were killed in military crackdowns. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
We here at RRB English Radio congratulate all our listeners worldwide on the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution.
In the limelight.
In the present world, although the necessity for preserving human dignity has been referred to by international circles, conventions, and declarations, what we see in practice is that every day human dignity is trampled upon with the tacit approval of the US and major European powers who unabashedly support the Zionist regime terrorism against the Palestinian people, says Kahan International staff writer in an article titled The Necessity of Armed Struggle for Palestinians. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Crises rise and abate all over the world, but the chronic question of Zionist-occupied Palestine persists with no solution in sight and no serious concern to the almost daily desecration of Islamic sanctities by the Zionist regime. Al-Aqsa, Islam's third holiest site, was again stormed the other day by armed Zionist thugs chanting slogans against the oppressed Palestinian people, while the Zionist regime's security forces stood as silent spectators to the growing trampling of human dignity and rights. In the present world, although the necessity for preserving human dignity has been referred to by international circles, conventions, and declarations, what we see in practice is that every day human dignity is trampled upon with the tacit approval of the US and major European powers who unabashedly support the Zionist regime's terrorism against the Palestinian people. What should the people of Palestine, whether those living under direct Zionist usurpation in the West Bank, Beit al-Muqaddas, and in 1948 occupied areas, or in the small besieged sliver called Gaza do, when their plight knows no end? Not a day passes when they are not targeted by the usurpers of their homeland and are killed like sitting ducks by the Zionist regime troops and Jewish settlers streaming in illegally from various parts of the world to seize the lands of the Palestinians and to practice their skills with newly acquired rifles by taking pot shots at the helpless men, women, and children. And if the Palestinians dare to defend themselves, they are branded terrorists and denounced as heartless brutes, with the Western media joining the Zionists to highlight violent crimes against the peaceful and peace-loving Israelis. The UN, especially its Security Council, looks the other way, while the regimes ruling the Arab states have no interest other than lip service for the chronic question of Palestine and are now committing open treason by normalizing ties with the usurper regime of Israel. This has emboldened the Zionists to trespass with impunity on the sacred sites of Islam in Beit al-Muqaddas, as was evident the other day when the Zionist regime's troops and so-called settlers joined together to desecrate the holy precincts of Al-Aqsa Mosque. It is now time for the Palestinians to realize that mere protest in Beit al-Muqaddas, stone throwing at the heavily armed Zionists in the West Bank, and a few crude projectiles fired at occupiers from Gaza, although commendable acts, are not enough to scare their enemies, let alone drive them away from the usurped land of Palestine. In other words, only a well-organized armed struggle with asymmetric forms of modern warfare, including guided missiles and remote-controlled radar-evading drones, is the only solution to redress their plight that requires fed sacrifices in view of the savage, racist, and terroristic nature of the fabricated regime of Israel. It is certainly no crime nor terrorism for an oppressed, occupied, and usurped people to acquire whatever forms of defense equipment that is possible to procure through any means in order to protect their life, their dignity, their religious sites, their land, their families, their faith, and their cultural heritage. The important point, however, is to be on guard against pressures, threats, and deception of both the implacable foes like the US, Britain, and France, and those Arab regimes now openly dallying with the Zionist regime, such as the UAE and Bahrain, with the Saudis covertly conversing with the Zionists. To be more precise, unless the Palestinian people resist and refuse with firm conviction any of those much-tried useless methods of talks, negotiations, and mediation that have yielded no results over the past 7 decades, their situation will never change, let alone their steady slide into not just second- or third-class citizens, but slaves of the Zionists in their own ancestral land. An important point to note is that defense technology, in addition to being available on the international market, can be assembled through accessible data on the websites, and there is no shortage of helping hands. All it needs is ingenuity by the Palestinians, as the Yemenis have shown, with complete trust in divine assistance and full confidence in their own abilities.
Thank you. This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z coming to you from IRIB English Radio. This program is on Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different topic. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, we love his name. Dear brothers and sisters, we all know that Allah can't be seen with our eyes. So, our story, the story of us human beings and our relationship with Allah, is just like the famous story of Layli and Majnun, which is the famous story in Farsi literature. And Majnun was in love with Layli, but he couldn't see her. He didn't know where she was. He couldn't reach her. So he would write her name on the sand, and he would just be happy watching it and walking around it. And he was pleased with her name because he had no other sign of her. So we too, we only know a number of names from Allah, but we love those names and we live our lives with the love of those names, you know. And the name Allah, it's just like the word flower. When you say flower, it includes like every single flower on earth, right? It includes roses and violets and jasmines and daffodils and so on and so forth. But when you say daffodil, it doesn't include jasmines, you know. The name Allah, it's just like the name flower. When you say Allah, it includes all the names of Allah, all the thousand names of Allah. Ghaffar, meaning forgiver. Sattar, meaning coverer. Mu'min, meaning secure. But once you say Sattar, it doesn't mean mu'min. So when we say in the name of Allah, we're saying in the name of the one who is the forgiver, the secure, the coverer, and so on and so forth. You know, all of his 1,000 names. So we can say that the name of Allah is the only word that can't be translated into any other language because it includes all of those 1,000 names of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. This is A to Z coming to you from IRIB English Radio. We're talking about how we as Muslims, we start everything in the name of Allah and how the name of Allah includes all his 1,000 names. So we're starting in the name of the one who is the forgiver, the secure, the coverer, the revenger, and all the other names of Allah. So in a narration, the messenger of Allah, Prophet Muhammad al-Mustafa, peace be upon him and his pure progeny, has said, anything which does not start with the name of Allah is cut off from Allah's blessing. So, you know, it's customary for us Muslims to begin everything in the name of Allah. When we wake up, we start our day with his name. We're asking him to help us throughout our day, you know, with his remembrance, with his help. We're asking him to help us go through our day with his remembrance and his help. And we step out of the house with his name. We ask him to help us remain on his path and not to take a single step in the way that pleases the Satan. And we begin our meals with his name. We ask him to give us energy and strength through the food that we're eating. So we want to be a good servant for him, you know. And when we want to give a speech or when we want to write something important, we start in his name. So we're asking him to help us to only say or write the truth and nothing but the truth. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's program, A to Z. Don't forget to log into our website, parsetoday.com. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The onus is now on the international community to force Tel Aviv into dismantling its apartheid regime. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written jointly by Ramzi Barod and Romana Rubeo, journalist. This article is titled Raids, Arrests and Death Threats, Israeli Regime's Strategy of Silencing Human Rights Defenders. Stay tuned for the details, please. On October 21st, Israeli regime war minister Benny Gantz announced the issuance of a military order designating six prominent Palestinian human rights groups as terrorist organizations. Gantz claimed that they are secretly linked to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, PFLP, a socialist political group that the Israeli regime considers a terrorist organization. The Palestinian organization included in the Israeli regime order are Al-Damir, Prisoner Support and Human Rights, Al-Haq, the Bison Center for Research and Development, Defense for Children Palestine, Union of Agricultural Work Committees, UAWC, and the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees. Considering the significance of these organizations in Palestine and their global networks among like-minded civil society organizations, the Israeli regime decision provoked a public outcry. One of the many statements of the condemnation was a joint statement by rights groups, Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, HRW, in which they call Gantz's move an appalling and unjust decision, which represents an attack by the Israeli regime on the international human rights movement. Amnesty International and HRW, which have documented Israeli human rights violations of Palestinians for many years, fully understand that the terrorist designation is consistent with a long trajectory of such unlawful moves. For decades, Israeli regime authorities have systematically sought to muzzle human rights monitoring and punish those who criticize its repressive rule over Palestinians. While staff members of organizations have faced deportation and travel bans, Palestinian human rights defenders have always borne the brunt of the repression. This decision is an alarming escalation that threatens to shut down the work of Palestine's most prominent civil society organizations. Equally important in the world's leading rights group's statement is that it did not fail to highlight that the decades-long failure of the international community to challenge grave Israeli human rights abuses and impose meaningful consequences for them has emboldened Israeli regime authorities to act in this brazen manner. True to form, the international community did react to Gantz's decision, albeit it was the kind of ineffectual reaction which persisted in the realm of rhetoric that is rarely followed by substantive action. A joint statement by UN experts called the Israeli regime decision a frontal attack on the Palestinian human rights movement and on human rights everywhere. Michelle Bachelet, United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, criticized the arbitrary decision by the Zionist regime and warned of the far-reaching consequences as a result in terms of work, funding and support for the targeted organizations. Many governments around the world also condemned the Israeli regime move and echoed the sentiment conveyed by UN experts. Even the United States expressed its concern, though, using the same typically cautious and non-committal language. U.S. State Department spokesman Ned Price told reporters on October 23rd in Washington that his country believes respect for human rights, fundamental freedoms, and a strong civil society are critically important to responsible and responsive governance. Instead of an outright condemnation, however, Price said that the United States will be engaging Israeli partners for more information regarding the basis for these designations, unquote. However, like other governments, and certainly unlike Amnesty International and HRW, Price made no link between the Israeli regime decision of October 21st and numerous other past practices targeting human rights and civil society groups in Palestine, and more recently, in the occupied territories as well. Also worth noting is that the supposed link between such organizations and the socialist PFLP is not new. At Damir in December 2012, the Israeli regime army raided the headquarters of Damir in Ramallah, confiscating laptops and a video camera. The offices of the Union of Palestinian Women Committees were also raided by the Zionist regime occupation forces on the same day. The organization is one of the six now designated by the Zionist regime as terrorists. In September 2019, Damir's offices were raided once again. The Israeli regime military raid at the time, however, did not generate as much attention or outrage, despite the accompanying violence, let alone the blatant violation of human rights. Then, Al-Haq, also one of the other six effectively banned Palestinian groups, issued a statement warning that the private property of human rights organizations in occupied territories is especially protected under Article 46 of the Hague Regulations. Expectedly, such legal constraints mattered little to the Zionist regime. Al-Haq's staff have faced many restrictions throughout the years. Shawan Jabarin, the general director of Al-Haq, has been banned from travel on various occasions starting in 2006. In March 2009, Jabarin was prevented by the Zionist regime from traveling to the Netherlands to receive an award on behalf of his organization. Again, in November 2011, this time, Jabarin was now allowed to travel to Denmark. The Zionist regime obstacles began taking even more sinister turns when, in March 2016, Jabarin began receiving death threats over the phone. These anonymous calls began arriving in the context of increasing harassment of Al-Haq and its members. Amid their recent work at the International Criminal Court, ICC, seeking justice for human rights violations, being committed in the occupied Palestinian territories, the Frontline Defenders website reported. Defense for Children International Palestine in July and again August 2021, Israeli regime forces raided Defense for Children International Palestine DCIP offices in Al Bira in the occupied West Bank. They seized computers, hard drives, and other material, alleging a link between the organization and the PFLP. This allegation had already been advanced in 2018 when UK lawyers for the Israeli regime, UKLFI, persuaded Sri Bank and the Arab Bank, PLC, to stop providing banking services to DCIP, providing what they defined as evidence of the close ties to PFLP. While it is true that the recent Israeli regime measures against Palestinian NGOs are a continuation of an old policy, there are fundamental differences between the growing perception of the fake regime of Israel now as an apartheid regime and the misconstrued perception of the past. In December 2019, and after years of haggling, the ICC resolved that there is a reasonable basis to proceed with an investigation into the situation in Palestine, pursuant to Article 53 of the Rome Statute. Despite intense Israeli regime and Western pressure, the last hurdle in the way of the investigation was removed last February, as the ICC has finally approved the prosecutor's request to open legal proceedings regarding war crimes in the occupied Palestinian territories, including Gaza. This legal milestone was cemented by major declarations, one made by Israel's own rights group B'Tselem in January and another by HRW in April, both slamming the Israeli regime policies in Palestine, not just the occupied territories as apartheid. This critical change in the international legal position regarding the Zionist regime's new unflattening status was boosted by Israel's own violent actions in East Al-Quds, Gaza, and throughout Palestine in May. Unlike previous wars, the May events have shifted sympathy mostly towards Palestinians who are fighting for their freedom, homes, and other basic human rights. The change was also notable within the U.S. government itself, which is unprecedented by any account. An increasing number of U.S. lawmakers are now openly critical of the regime of Israel due to a radical change in the U.S. public opinion. And again, unprecedentedly, they are not paying a heavy price for it, as was often the case in the past due to the great influence of the Zionist lobby in Washington. The shift is dramatic, it's tectonic, reporters on May 21st quoted U.S. pollster John Zogby as saying. In particular, younger generations are considerably more sympathetic to Palestinians, and that age gap has been on full display with the Democratic Party. The Zionist regime's losses are not just sentimental or political, but economic as well. Last July, the international ice cream giant Ben & Jerry's decided to stop selling its products in illegal Jewish settlements while pinpointedly condemning the Israeli regime occupation, a move that was described by Amnesty International as legitimate and necessary. A few months later, the sports clothing manufacturer Nike followed suit, announcing that it will end the sale of its products in Israeli stores starting on May 2nd, 2022, although it did not justify its decision based on political reasoning. While the Zionist regime continues to lash out at its critics, it no longer seems to behave according to a centralized strategy. Lacking a strong leadership after the dethroning of former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and formation of a diverse unity regime, The new Israeli regime does not seem capable of holding back international criticism of its conduct in occupied Palestine. The notion that everything that the Israeli regime does is justifiable as a form of self-defense is simply no longer a strong selling point. The May War is a perfect example of this assertion. In the case of the banned NGOs, for example, aside from sending a representative from the Israeli regime intelligence agency, Shin Bet, and another from Israeli regime foreign ministry to Washington on October 25th, with relevant intelligence to justify its decision, Tel Aviv continued to carry out the same policies that further exposes its apartheid in the eyes of the international community. Indeed, on October 27th, the Israeli regime announced the construction of thousands of new housing units in illegal Jewish settlements in its first such move during the presidency of Joe Biden. A perfect illustration of the frantic nature of the Israeli regime response came on October 29th, when the Israeli regime envoy to the United Nations, Gilad Erdan, during his speech at the General Assembly, tore into pieces a report issued by the Human Rights Council illustrating Israeli regime ongoing violations of international law. Erdan said the Human Rights Council attacked and condemned Israel in 95 resolutions compared to 142 resolutions against the rest of the world. He ranted, "This distorted and one-sided report's place is in the dustbin of anti-Semitism." We may be at the cusp of a fundamental change in terms of the Israeli regime's relationship with the international community. While Tel Aviv continues to heavily invest in its apartheid infrastructure, the international community is slowly but clearly becoming aware that the Israeli regime's apartheid status is a permanent one. The successive statements by B'Tselem, HRW, the joint HRW-Amnesty statement condemning the de facto outlawing of the Palestinian NGOs and again the ICC investigation are all indicative of this growing awareness. The question remains, will the fake regime of Israel be able to use its power, influence, and leverage in Western societies to force the world to accept and coexist with a full-fledged apartheid regime in Palestine? And if yes, then for how long? A critical mass of support for Palestinian rights is being constructed around the world thanks to the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, that is BDS movement, and hundreds of pro-Palestine civil society groups all around the globe. For years, the fake regime of Israel seemed keen on countering the influence of Palestine solidarity around the world using a centralized strategy. Large sums of money were dedicated or pledged towards that end, and a partly government-controlled company was even established in 2017 to guide the Israeli regime global campaign. Much of this has amounted to very little, however, as BDS continues to grow and the conversation on Palestine and the Zionist regime is gradually changing from that of a political conflict into the recognition of Israeli regime racism, apartheid, and utter disregard of international law. Of course, it will take more time, more decided effort, and certainly more sacrifices on the part of Palestinians and their supporters to expose Israeli regime apartheid to the rest of the world. Now that the fake regime of Israel seems to have accepted that there is little it can do to reverse this brand, it is accelerating its colonial efforts while hunkering down for a long fight ahead. The onus is now on the international community to force the Israeli regime into dismantling its apartheid regime. Though it is ultimately the people who liberate themselves, the international solidarity is essential to the process of national liberation.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more. No more. No more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, Hadith of the Day, here at IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us here. Today on Hadith of the Day, we're going to be looking at a very beautiful tradition narrated from the eighth Imam of the family of the Prophet, alayhi wasalam, Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam. This beautiful tradition is about the value of the belief in Allah's unity, and also it alludes to the meaning of this unity as well. The Imam alayhi salam says, the very first step to Allah's worship is to attain inner knowledge of Him. Meaning, if we want to attain the worship of Allah, if we want to worship Allah, we should first have knowledge of Allah, who Allah is, right? So our worship, right, it's conditioned with our knowledge of God. And this is alluding to the value of the belief in Allah's unity. And the Imam in continuation says, and the origin of attaining inner knowledge of Allah, exalted be His praise, is through His divine unity. Or to explain it another way, the basis and the foundation of the knowledge of Allah is to affirm His unity. Meaning, if we want to know who God is, properly know who God is, and recognize Him, let's translate this hadith in this way, we have to affirm that He is one. Affirm His oneness. This indirectly indicates that the value of our worship is based upon our assessing and affirming God's unity. Then the Imam says, the very basis of His divine unity, or the very foundation of affirming His unity, is what? Is to negate any kind of limitation from Him. Meaning, if we want to understand why He is one, or the reason why He is one, we should understand that He is not limited. He's unlimited, He's infinite, His existence is boundless, and therefore He cannot, there cannot be more than one of such a being. This is very similar to a tradition narrated from Imam Ali regarding God's unity. In any case, in continuation, the Imam explains why is it that God's unity is founded on the negation of limitation from Him. The Imam says, since the intellects are able to witness that every limited being is created, everything that's limited is created. So if something is not created, something is not a makhluk, is not a creature, rather it's a creator, it's a God, He should be unlimited. If He's unlimited, right, He's infinite, He's boundless, He cannot be more than one. Once we've established this, we've understood His unity, we have achieved the ma'rifat and the knowledge of God, and this can serve as a foundation of our worship. Now we know who we're worshiping, and our worship has value. Right? So this tradition here, the Imam alayhi salam, establishes the value of God's, the belief in God's unity, by saying that this belief and this understanding is what gives value to our worship of Allah, and then when this worship is valuable, you know, we will attain its reward in the hereafter and become eternally felicitous. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Oh Lord, here I am pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
This spotlight.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.